Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Each year there's a major effort around the world to combat invasive species. Seems like every year there's a new story. One year it's Burmese pythons destroying all small mammals in the Everglades. Remember the flying European carp videos where fish would go flying into boats on Illinois waterways? One year it's zebra mussels, Yellowstone lake trout, next kudzu, tamarisk, or water hyacinths. Conventional wisdom is that these species cause the extinctions of native species in the area, there's a loss of biodiversity, and cost our economy lots of money. Well, my guest today says that's not necessarily the case, and in many examples, just plain not true. Fred Pierce is an environmental reporter. He writes for The Guardian, he's a consultant for New Scientist, and has written a pragmatic and controversial book which argues for a more nuanced view of how we view invasive species. He writes that invasive species have been a constant in nature, and with human habitation, changes in natural systems always are accelerated, and that alien species, while initially exploiting these changes, will be overcome by balance in the system, usually will always return, with or without our eradication efforts. His book is titled The New Wild, Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation. It's a very interesting book. It's published by Beacon Press. Fred Pierce is my guest today. Fred Pierce, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
What made you decide to examine the effects of invasive species? When you think about invasive species, they're almost always bad for every environmental community, ecosystem. It's just sort of a given. What made you decide to examine the claims that invasive species are always bad for a natural population?
Well, really, because I began to think that some of the stories told were myths, really. It's not that invasive species never do any harm, that alien species coming in from outside can't be a problem for fisheries or farmers or forestry or whatever it might be. But in many of the ecological stories told, it seemed to be myths. I mean, I'm a journalist. I've written plenty of stories telling how the damage that they can cause, and some of those stories are certainly true. But I thought that there was another story to be told. Many invasive species have a good side. They can colonize areas, for instance, that humans have messed up. You go and look in sort of badland urban environments, polluted former industrial sites, waste tips, that kind of thing. Even just disturbed land that people have dug over and left. Very often it's outsiders, it's the colonist species, it's the go-getters, if you like, the kind of true Americans, if I can put it that way. I'm a Brit, you know, I can think in those terms, are the ones that move in and colonize and take over and make something of a quite difficult environment. So I think, you know, there is a positive story to be told, and it chimes with some new ecological thinking today. Many environmentalists, conservationists have traditionally thought of ecosystems as kind of pristine environments, perfected places, places that we should make sure are as unchanged as possible, and that change is bad in ecosystems.
Yeah, but basically the idea is that you're preserving a moment in time.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of preservationist agenda. But the new ecology, a lot of new ecologists are saying, look, nature isn't like that. Nature on its own, leaving aside human presence, is constantly changing, constantly adapting to new situations. Species are constantly coming and going all the time. And that's a kind of perfectly natural process, part of the dynamism of nature, part of evolution, you might say. So, you know, if you fit those two ideas together, there's nothing intrinsically bad about an alien species coming in. Can be disruptive, but maybe disruption is good.
Now, of course, what preservationists will say is that, well, it's man bringing in these invasive species. They're not making it on their own. They're attaching a ride on a freighter. They're latching onto a boat and moving to another waterway hundreds of miles away. And that's unnatural in of itself. How do you address that?
Well, that's true. And that, you know, that kind of loads the dice a bit. It creates a new dynamic in there. But I do think the majority of those species, many of them disappear, of course. They just don't take in the new environment, however they arrive there. But the majority kind of settle in. If you look at the plant population of North America, for instance, there's about 25% more species here than there was before Europeans showed up 500 years ago. So there have been very few extinctions, in fact, no recorded extinctions, I think I'm right in saying, in North America as a result directly of the arrival of outside species. So the idea that they cause mass extermination is of the natives is not really true. They've kind of added to biodiversity. They've added to yes, there have been some problems, but there are more species here. So it kind of looks like a good news story to me. Not that there are no problems, but, you know, there is nothing intrinsically bad about even the ones that Europeans brought in. And remember, you know, nature can do international movement of species anyway. A lot of species show up in the guts of migrating birds, for instance, or on driftwood crossing the oceans. So even transcontinental migration is not entirely a human activity.
You tell this amazing story of a jetty in Japan that broke apart during the tsunami, landed on the Oregon beach, crossed the Pacific. You said there were immediately preservationists and environmentalists got in on this, breaking up this jetty, because they said there were up to 90 invasive species on that jetty.
Well, and I'm sure that's true, and they saw that as, well, you know, this couldn't, you know, how can we allow this to happen? But if you think about it, okay, the jetty was man-made, but the tsunami certainly wasn't man-made. It could just as easily have been some driftwood coming across as a wooden jetty. So it, to all intents and purposes, that was an entirely natural process. And if you think about over thousands and millions of years, there are obviously these things happening all the time. So the natural potential for species to move around the world, smaller stuff can, you know, get up in the wind and stay there for quite long distances. The natural potential for these movements is very great. So humans are speeding things up and making some choices sometimes. You know, weird stuff shows up. So Burmese pythons in the Florida Everglades, I mean, they got there because somebody had a sort of pet farm there, and a hurricane came in and broke down the walls and they escaped. Now, that kind of thing wouldn't happen in nature. But, you know, maybe the scale of the damage that we're doing to the natural environment means we need an extra level of migration around the world of species just for nature to keep up. So I'm not convinced that, you know, when we throw the dice in this kind of way for nature, that we're necessarily doing harm. There may be circumstances where we want to try and row back and try and do something about migration, but very often it's a kind of good news story. This is more biodiversity on the planet. Conservationists tell us, and I believe it's true, that more biodiversity is good. And if alien species are creating more biodiversity, maybe that's good too.
And this is one of the things you found as you investigated the myth behind some of these invasive species. You found that what the species was capitalizing on was not coming to, say, a alien Eden and basically running rampant. It was mainly an environmentally degraded ecosystem in which there were no natural predators, and it was sort of taking root in a place that other animal and plant species had abandoned.
Well, that's right. I mean, there are lots of good examples. Perhaps one of the best documented examples is in Puerto Rico, where farmers over the centuries had destroyed most of the forests on that island and created plantations and so on, so it's pretty treeless. Then the farmers largely abandoned, in the last half century, largely abandoned that land, which is pretty degraded by then. And you look at what happened. Well, you'd expect nature to reinvade, but the native species couldn't do it. You know, the baked, salt-infested soils, the arid landscape, the native species, the species that began to reclaim those fields were principally trees that had been brought in by European colonists, and they were fruit trees. The African tulip tree, which had been planted in a few gardens by colonists at various points, suddenly started moving in and became the prime mover to reclaiming these lands. And then birds started nesting in the branches of these alien trees as they moved across. Insects came in, pollination started happening. Before you know where you are, the natives are moving in. But the primary colonists were, it turned out, alien species. Without them, there wouldn't be a reforesting going on in Puerto Rico. So I think that's not an unusual story. It's emblematic around the world. You quite often find that the alien species that have taken root are really very good colonists, and they can be very useful if you're trying to recreate nature on a messed up environment. If we're going to have ecological recovery in the 21st century, I think we can certainly learn lessons from the way alien species can colonize, and maybe it's the alien species that will often need to do it.
Now, earlier you said you began to investigate the effects of invasive species, and you found a number of myths. What's perhaps the biggest myth surrounding these invasive species?
I think the biggest myth is that they cause mass extinctions among native species. You often read this, and some quite alarming statistics are occasionally produced about the extent to which they cause native extinctions. But the reality is that that very, very rarely happens. Now, in Hawaii, which has a very sort of particular history and had some sort of unusual set of native species, invaders coming in have done some damage there, though the overall biodiversity is greater. But in most places, most of the time, you can see that whether you're in Europe or Australia or New Zealand or, you know, many Pacific islands, even certainly North America, the net effect is very few extinctions among native species. Usually the alien species just kind of find new things to do in the environment. They don't expel others. So you have an addition to biodiversity. So I think that's the biggest myth, the myth that they cause mass extinctions. And you wouldn't say it never happens, but it's pretty rare.
Now, that's the one thing I sort of took away from the book, was that there's it's a difference between an island and a large landmass.
On an island, where you do have sort of horror stories, they tend to be on very small islands with really, you know, really very limited ecosystems. They're basically sort of seabird colonies and not a lot else. And if you, as has happened in many places, ships come in, whaling ships or fishing boats or something, and some rats come ashore. And if they start eating their way through the seabird colonies, you know, there aren't any trees very often, you know, they can cause mayhem. There's absolutely no doubt about that. They can kill every last bird on the island if you give them time. But those are kind of the exceptions, you know. If you've got a reasonably sort of kind of sophisticated ecosystem with a lot of species interacting, if you've got a fair amount of land, it doesn't even have to be a, you know, whole continent, just something beyond a little sort of speck in the middle of the ocean. By and large, the result is a proliferation of species. Nature just kind of, you know, the new species find things to do. They find new ecological niches in the environment, if you want to use that kind of language. They add to the richness. It's the kind of the more the merrier.
My guest today is Fred Pierce, an environmental consultant, a new scientist, an environmentalist journalist, and his new book is titled The New Wild, Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation. Interesting idea, and it's probably is making some people's heads explode, and in others it's probably saying, wow, this is a new way to think about this. And getting back to the islands, you open the book with a story of two South Atlantic islands, Ascension Island, and I believe it's Gough Island. Is it Gough Island?
That's right. Gough, yeah. Yeah, after the guy who discovered it, I think some shipman, you know, a long time ago. Yeah, I mean, Gough Island tells the story of what happens when, in fact, in this case, it wasn't rats, it was mice that came ashore there. And they evolved to be bigger, and they evolved to be highly carnivorous, and they're working their way through the ground nesting birds on that island. It is one of the, you know, one of the world's largest seabird colonies. So obviously that's, you know, they're doing a huge amount of damage. There's no doubt about that. But then there's Ascension Island. These islands are both in the South Atlantic, pretty far away from anything else. Ascension Island, I visited. It's a small British colony there. There's a U.S. airstrip on there, which gets used quite a lot by the American Navy and so on. But it's quite a small island. Before humans showed up, it was basically a volcanic hulk. There was very little wildlife there. But Europeans started planting trees because they thought that would be a nice thing to do in their new land there. And they've created this kind of instant ecosystem, a sort of accidental rainforest, if you want to put it that way, all the way across the island, particularly on Green Mountain, the place they call Green Mountain, which wasn't green before. And, I mean, these are trees that have come in. The British brought them in mainly, so some came in from the Caribbean colonies, and some came from South Africa, some came from Brazil, some came from Australia, Malaysia, all over, just kind of almost random planting of trees. And some of the trees came with a few insects and so on. And out of nothing, this well-functioning rainforest ecosystem has been created on this mountain. Now, that breaks all the rules of conventional ecology, which says that, you know, rainforests are things that evolve over millions of years, and every species has to evolve to fill its particular niche. Well, nothing much has evolved there. It's just showed up, and species have made the best of what was going on there. So this is a very different model of how nature works. nature just kind of shows up and gets on with it. And there's, you know, there's a bit of co-evolution go on, but mostly it's nature making it up as it goes along. For me, that's a rather optimistic story because it tells me that almost whatever damage humans do on the planet, and we've for sure done an awful lot, nature can recover. Nature has great powers of recovery. Species can kind of, you know, find a way. And we can, and I think conservationists should be thinking much more about how we can encourage those processes. So the conventional idea is, as we were saying earlier about conservation, is you're trying to protect what we see as sort of perfect and pristine. And we think of it as kind of passive and fragile. And, you know, if we mess it up, we've messed it up for good. But I think, you know, nature doesn't work that way. Nature is much more dynamic. Nature is much more can do. And we ought to be encouraging those processes, encouraging that dynamism. If you think about it, if we got climate change coming down the track, how is nature going to deal with climate change? How is it going to adapt to climate change? Well, it's done it in the past with natural climate change, and it'll do it again by species moving very often. So actually, alien species moving around the world is going to be part of how nature adapts to climate change. So we need to encourage those processes. You know, we ought to be kind of conserving the dynamism rather than conserving the past, if you like.
I want to ask about a couple of species that you write about, American invasive species that symbolize how a lot of people think of an invasive species. And you refer to it as sort of demonizing a lot of these species. And that's kudzu in the American Southeast and tamarisk in the West. And one of the things you try to do is say, well, okay, what's the exact figure of damage these invasive species are causing? What did you find?
Well, tamarisk is rather interesting. It got demonized for a long time as it was sucking up the water of the West. Now, that was an interesting story about how you think about deserts, because it was originally introduced. It's an old world weed, basically. It was introduced because it appeared to be able to colonize desert areas, which is true because it can sink its roots down way deep. So if you want to revegetate a desert landscape, it's a great thing to put in. And that's why the soil conservation people in the 1930s were very keen on planting tamarisk, or salt cedar, as some people call it. But it got so good that people then started worrying that it was sucking up the water supplies. So it was creating desert in a hydrological sense. So there was then a kind of reaction against that. It turns out that it doesn't really consume more water than natives like cottonwood, for instance, or willow trees in the same environment. But it kind of got demonized. And that's strange. I mean, we now discover that it's really quite useful as a place for a number of endangered bird species in the American West. So ecologists are now thinking that maybe it's a good thing. So we have these sort of cultural phases where we want to promote something that's new, and then we have a reaction against them. And then we kind of demonize them again. And then we have to do another rethink. One of the things they discovered, actually, is that tamarisk does best in river valleys where there's a dam upstream. So you lose the sort of flood flows coming down, and you have a much more kind of ordered, regular water regime coming down because the dam's holding the water back for hydroelectricity or whatever, or irrigation maybe. And under those circumstances, very artificial kind of man-made circumstances, tamarisk tends to do rather well. If you still got the sort of natural flood regime, it doesn't do so well, and cottonwood tends to do better. Mm. So you have these complex sort of interactions between sort of human landscapes and how alien species do. And tamarisk seems to do quite well in a landscape or in river valleys that are being managed by humans.
And one of the things you found was that what helped demonize this plant was the fact that there were people who wanted to reclaim the water that tamarisk was using as sort of a water rights issue. And so they said, well, we'll get rid of the tamarisk, and that way we can use more water.
That's right. I mean, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating story. It was the mining companies in the 1930s and going on into the 1940s who needed water for their operations. But all the water, we're talking about in the arid West, all the water was allocated to farmers. The only way they could claim any water was if they could somehow show that they kind of created water, if you like, in the arid environment. So they employed scientists, if I can be crude about it, to talk up the numbers. about how much water tamarisk was taking from the environment, so that they could say, well, we'll strip out the tamarisk, we'll remove it, we'll calculate how much water we've saved by doing that, and then we can have that water from the rivers and use it in our mining operations. And the government got involved in that when we needed metals during the Second World War. So it almost became part of the war effort to attack tamarisk. Unfortunately, the research that's been done since has shown that wherever tamarisk or when tamarisk has been removed from river valleys, there's no evidence of any increase in the amount of water in the river. So again, that seemed to have been myth-making. In that case, not so much environmentalists making the myth, but the mining companies. Mm. So one of the weird things out in the American West is that almost the only thing that environmentalists, mining companies, and river managers can agree on is that tamarisk is the evil weed. But it turns out it isn't really.
Now, you found the same thing with kudzu. I mean, you wrote that kudzu is so thoroughly demonized. You said, well, okay, let's see the studies that show us the effects of kudzu in the Southeast. And you said, nobody's even researched it because it's just so thoroughly believed that nobody's actually quantified what, if any, damage kudzu's doing.
Yeah, I found that rather interesting. I mean, I think that's just a failure of scientists. I mean, I wouldn't say that kudzu isn't a problem in parts of the Deep South. Clearly it is. But it was something which was brought in by humans as a valuable soil conservation crop. It was also a valuable fodder crop. It's partly gone sort of wild and crazy now because we don't need it for fodder anymore. Many of the pastures are no longer there. The landscape is being wooded more now. And as a result, it's kind of a leftover from old farming systems. Sure, it's got out of hand. You know, we've all seen the pictures of how it just kind of takes over everything. And I wouldn't say that's not a problem and that's something which we have to deal with. But it's something which has arisen from, if you like, our changing needs on the land. Kudzu used to be useful for the way that we manage the land there, and now it's a problem. But, you know, that's something we've got to kind of face up to.
I want to ask you about another a species in Africa, which it's the water hyacinth. And this is a lot of tropical areas. It can just sort of clog waterways. But you found a specific location in Lake Victoria where water hyacinths really take over. But what a scientist found was that it's really sort of working as a filtration system. When the water's clean, it doesn't do well. When it's polluted and filthy, water hyacinths do really well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a pretty plant from the Amazon, basically. It lives in swamps in the upper reaches of the Amazon. European colonists took it around the world. It was a nice ornamental plant. People put it in their ponds, in their gardens, in Africa and Asia. And inevitably, it escaped and moved into the natural environment. It is a big problem when you have too many nutrients in the water, basically, if there's sewage pollution, industrial pollution, even when you're deforesting and you're getting a lot of silt coming into rivers. But what a hyacinth is doing well there because it's living on this stuff. It's soaking it up. So I would argue that it's a sign of a troubled water ecosystem. It's a sign of polluted rivers and lakes. But it's not the cause of them. And we often kind of blame the symptom, if you like, rather than doing something about the cause. The cause is the pollution we're putting into those lakes. Now, Lake Victoria is a good example because it's the largest lake in Africa. It's absolutely huge. And water hyacinth took over large areas of that lake and was a huge problem. You know, you couldn't get the ships in and out of port and, you know, fishermen couldn't go to collect their catches, that kind of thing. Really big problem. And then 1998, we had that big El Nino event. And in Africa, it caused unseasonal rains, and they flushed through the lake, and they cleaned the lake out. The pollution was gone, and the water hyacinth was gone. So that demonstrated very clearly that, you know, the real issue was the pollution. Now, it's starting to come back again now because the pollution is starting to build up again, and the water hyacinth is coming too. But I think the lesson is trying to get rid of water hyacinth is virtually impossible. People have tried many, you know, they tried chemicals and they tried bringing in beetles from the Amazon to try and eat it up. They tried all sorts of stuff. Really nothing works unless you actually deal with the symptom of the problem, which is the polluted water. So there are two ways of looking at this. I mean, alien species look like part of the problem, but I think they're a symptom of the problem. But they're also, you know, they were moderating the pollution in those environments because they're just soaking up huge amounts of pollution. You see a similar thing with zebra mussels, for instance, in the Great Lakes. I know they're a problem, and you know they cause difficulties for water intakes and jetties and you know human infrastructure. But they've done quite a good job of cleaning out quite a lot of the pollution, especially in Lake Erie, which is where they first showed up. When the zebra mussels showed up in Lake Erie half a century ago, it was a polluted mess, a real, almost kind of a dead lake. And these filter feeders have been working their way through that and cleaning it up. It's a lot cleaner than it used to be.
Can we attribute the cleaning up of the water to the zebra mussels themselves?
In some part. I mean, yes, humans have reduced the pollution as well. I wouldn't say that there's not been industrial effort to reduce that. But zebra mussels have played a very large part in... Now, some ecologists will say, yeah, but they've changed the ecosystem. It's not gone back to the natural ecosystem it would be before. And that, of course, is true. But some species have done really very well out of that. There's a lake sturgeon there, a kind of endangered species, which has thrived in the new clearer waters that have been created by the zebra mussels eating their way through the gunk. And the reason the zebra mussels got going was because the local mussels couldn't do that. There are local mussels, local filter feeders, but the pollution was too bad for them. But the zebra mussels, which came in from, they came in ballast water from the Caspian Sea, from Asia. And they found that they could work in that environment in a way that the local native species couldn't. So I think that's another example of how alien species brought in by humans can, by chance, it doesn't always happen, but by chance can start cleaning up environments or make a go of systems that native species couldn't. So you now have much clearer waters there. There's more plant growth on the bed of the lake. And it's quite a lot of, some fisheries have done worse, but many fisheries have done a lot better.
Your book really argues for a new approach and a moderation in how we view invasive species. Are there times we should actually try to fight an invasive species, an alien species moving into an ecosystem? I assume you're just advocating for a moderation in that view, but are there times we should actually fight an invasive species?
Yes, I'm sure there are. I mean, if you have something coming in which is damaging economic activity, it might be a kind of new kind of fungus or a new pest, that's a new insect that's eating its way through forests, or that, you know, there are clear economic reasons why we would want to address that. There are aesthetic reasons why we sometimes want to address alien species. They just, you know, they're damaging species that we like more. And I think, you know, in the modern world, we're perfectly entitled to do that. We're humans. They're human-dominated landscapes. We're entitled to say we want those species and not those ones. I think we have to accept that there are some limits about what we can do. We're not master of all that we survey. But we have a right to intervene. So, you know, if you have alien trout moving into streams where you have fisheries there that you prefer, you know, we're perfectly entitled to try and do something about that. We have to be careful of unintended ecological consequences of trying to eliminate species. We have to be aware that it may be difficult, but we have a perfect right to do that. What I think we should be careful about is thinking that we are doing nature a good turn by doing this, because I think nature often, the essence of nature is about the dynamism and it's about the constant change in ecosystems, and we're a bit inclined to believe that change is bad. I think nature has got a kind of different agenda.
Fred Pearce is an award-winning environmental author and journalist. His most recent book is titled The New Wild, Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation. It's published by Beacon Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.